This is Jay Thiemeyer for KABU, talking with Lech Majewski, whose films are being featured at the Northwest Film Center. They're being screened at the Witzel Auditorium next to the Art Museum downtown. Welcome to KABU. Lech, welcome.
Yes, hello. How are you?
It's nice to have you here. You've been very productive from the beginning. You've written poetry, you've written novels, you've done staged operas, you've been making films since film school in Poland, you've been in this country since 81 and naturalized in 89, and you currently live in Venice, Italy, among other places, and your geographic traveling is sort of representative of the span of production. I mean, you've been very prolific. And I would like to know, this interview will be aired after the screening of Gospel According to Harry and Glass Lips. But could you talk about those two as representing the themes that you've been cultivating during your career?
Well, my two films, which are shown here in Portland, Gospel According to Harry is a movie that actually the first leading part for Viggo Mortensen. This is kind of a visual poem that I wrote at one point. I spoke with David Lynch about the idea of having a contemporary gospel, so to say, because the gospel has been written 2,000 years ago. Almost, and the Gospels, the four of them, and they deal with different codicils, so to say. I mean, the major aspects are the same, but we were just playing with the idea, how would it be if somebody like that would write a gospel today? And this was this version written by a tax collector called Harry, and I put it a little bit in a futuristic terms because it deals... The story is about a couple who lives in an open desert, and from the dialogues there, we know that the Pacific has dried up, and therefore there is no water whatsoever, but the people somehow survive. So it's a futuristic, a little bit crazy kind of a version, a take on what it would be. Funnily enough, just recently I've been praised by many ecological societies and invited with this movie all around the world for the ecological reasons, because suddenly, you know, the problem of overheating and drying the land, you know, the land as a desert becomes a very present problem in our lives.
I can see that where that would be a big hit in Portland, being as environmentally conscious as we are.
Yeah, and the other movie, Glass Lips, is based on my installation called The Blood of a Poet, which is made of 33 video pieces, video art pieces that I assembled when I was invited 2 years ago. I was honored with the retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art. In a relatively, you know, my life didn't end yet, and I am not at the end of the road, I hope. But it was a big honor to have an individual retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And the curator of that retrospective, Mr. Lawrence Kardish, said it would be nice if we would open it with your new work, some sort of a world premiere. And at that time, I had four fresh video art pieces, and once I got this invitation, I started to work on this, on additional ones, and it grew up to this 33. And they'd been presented at MoMA in New York first, but from then on, it toured the world. It was presented in many countries, particularly also in Berlin during the Berlinale. And the Venice Biennale invited me this year, and it was open in June on two locations in Venice. One was, it was shown on plasma screens overlooking Campo San Pantalone, And it's going 24 hours a day for people. So a lot of people gather in front of this windows and watch it. It's like several thousand a day viewers. And also Biennale gave me a theater called Junkan Theater on Giudecca, on the island of Giudecca. And there is a 200-seater that plays it 8 hours a day on a loop. So you can visit indoors also if you want to contemplate. And from those elements, I assembled the movie called The Glass Lips, which the Portland Art Museum shows.
We'll be showing tonight as we're speaking, which will be before this interview is aired, but it's a wonderful film. I'm really looking forward to it. And you're going to be present there to answer questions, which maybe we can comment on later. I'm curious what sort of questions you got last night after Gospel According to Harry.
Well, after Gospel According to Harry, people were very curious that I found this desert in Poland, actually, but I shot it in Poland. But there are also questions about the approach to creating the images that I do, because my aesthetics, let's say, I think my images are, I take a lot of time to compose my images, and this shows. And people are always sort of flabbergasted. How can you achieve these effects by shooting natural, let's say, landscapes? And so people are always curious how you can achieve this effect or that effect. And this pretty much is a little bit of a technical explanation. How am I doing it? Because whatever you say, I started as a poet and as a painter. And I guess this stamp I am carrying throughout my work, whether it's theater or literature or films or art or opera that I wrote and staged and directed and filmed, this is my initial element is always a vision of it, an image. And also I find some symbolic way of showing it.
That's what impressed me with the screener I saw of Angelus, a film you came out with in 2000, which will be shown on the 30th of November, Friday at 8:45 at the Witzel. Could you talk about Angelus?
Angelus is a very unusual story. This is a story of a group of coal miners who were the painters. And during the communist years, they were presented as this working class artists who sort of come out of the mines and they paint just to beautify their relaxation time, so to say. It was this kind of a wishy-washy explanation of these paintings. But in fact, these people were the members of a Rosicrucian circle, and their painting were very much the criticism of what's going on. I mean, they were based on certain prophecies that the communism will eat up the world, that there were these three signs that they got from the scriptures, and one sign was that there would be a huge war, and it was the Second World War. Then there would be a red plague. So this is the Stalinist period in Russia and in Poland and in the whole Eastern countries. This was a horrid, horrid time for everybody. People were in prison for nothing, and they were tortured and killed, and you know, this is the biggest killer of the humankind. I mean, nobody can beat his record. He killed 30 million people, and he's still considered a hero by many, which is the utmost stupidity of humankind. I mean, I think he has more followers than Mother Teresa. This is a dangerous trait in human nature. I mean, how can you worship such a tyrant and a sheer killer and a murderer? So anyhow, these miners read it this way, and also they read the third prophecy that there'll be a huge mushroom and they interpreted the Nevada atomic blast as such a sign, and they try to save the world. And it's a kind of tragicomical tale as I presented it through the staging of their paintings. So I used their paintings as a vocabulary for the aesthetics. I mean, how to capture the world through their imagination, through their paintings, through their aesthetics. And it came in the form of tableaus, the way they are painting. And it produced a very unusual effect. It's a feature film, it tells a story, but at the same time it's quite unique in terms of the visuals and the type of narration. And yes.
Yes, this was this commune in Janov, is that the way you pronounce it?
Yes, Janov.
Existed from 1920 to 1960, from what roughly. And the film is placed in the 50s during the depths of the Stalinist era. You talk about totalitarianism and materialism to the exclusion. I've heard the film described as...
If I can interrupt you, I will just... I found certain facts which are very unusual in terms of Hitler and Stalin. I mean, two people who very much imprinted themselves and their cruelty and their absolutely dark nature on the whole world of the 20th century, particularly on my country, on Poland. I mean, that is a country that was ravaged, shattered, destroyed. The best of the best were killed by both of them, by Hitler and by Stalin. But these two guys, these two monsters share a similar traits. I mean, they were born on the same day, within the 10-year period. The same day they had their birthday. They were the third child in the family, and the two previous died on birth, stillborn. So they were the third and a lucky surviving child. They both withstood the attempts to kill them. They both were coming from small countries and ran big countries, because Hitler came from Austria and ran Germany, and Stalin came from Georgia and ran the entire Soviet Union. They were the same height, and so on and so on. There is so many traits, in a strange way, that these two men have shared in astrological terms, and even, you know, the third child that survives of the family. It's very, very unusual, very weird, very strange, I mean, disturbing. But anyhow, yes.
Does astrology, I take it that astrology and Rosicrucianism are factors in your creative approach?
Not really. I mean, I am... It's hard to say that there are in a direct way. I respect them, but I don't know too much about them. But I definitely have these readings, and I consider them as one of the factors that shapes the world or creates the world. But this is not the ultimate factor. I think that whatever the make of the human being is, that's a number of factors that are responsible for the make. But I think there is a trait of this astrological interpretation which one can take into consideration.
You don't dismiss it by any means?
No. Right. No, we don't have enough knowledge to dismiss basically anything. I mean, dismissing anything, it only can show the lack of knowledge.
The lack of knowledge. Totalitarianism. I'm thinking about the people being terrorized by Hitler and Stalin, that sort of taking that fear into them to the point where they identify with the terrorist, these totalitarian terrorists, Hitler and Stalin, so that this is what they're accustomed to. They feel safe in this terror, to the point where they want to see it perpetuated and not eliminated forever. Sort of see that as similar to the internees in the camps under Hitler who identify with their oppressors, the jailers. And would that be fair to say as an aside here?
Well, we're entering a very broad subject, so I don't think my films are really connecting in such a profound way with this. Yes, definitely. I mean, there's always this mysterious shadow in a human psyche that we want to dismiss, but yet the dismissal of it produces the most tragic effects, because one has to live with the idea that there is this dark side of the moon, so to say, in human beings. And they, you know, Hitler wasn't alone, Stalin wasn't alone. They had a huge and loving apparatus to implement their will, however sick it was. And you know, I don't want to get too political, but you don't need to look too far to see how the evil works on many levels.
Well, let's move then to The Garden of Earthly Delights, which will be screened on Wednesday the 28th at 7 o'clock, again at the Witzel. The Witzel is across from the Art Museum downtown. Could you talk about that film?
The Garden of Earthly Delights is a movie that I made based on my novel Metaphysics. And the Metaphysics is a story of... this is a love story. A man is losing a woman. She's dying. She's an art historian, and she writes about the Garden of Earthly Delights, the famous Hieronymus Bosch painting. And he takes her for a trip to Venice, which is my home, let's say. I mean, most of my books actually happen in Venice. That's my spiritual landscape, I would say. And they rent an apartment, and they try to live like inside this painting. They try. She has this will of being physically a part of this painting, which deals with this harmonious union, sort of pantheistic union between the humans and fruits and animals. And you have to see the painting to understand it. It's just like those creatures that are united in this sort of pan-religion of love and happiness and unification. And she tries to live it while she's dying. And he records her with a little camera. And then he, in the book, when she's gone, he writes a number of letters to her. Because he says in these letters, you know, you physically might be gone, but spiritually you are in me. And you touched something very deep in me, which was asleep, and I want to communicate with you, so I'm writing to you. And so these are the love letters to a woman who is physically no more with us, but she is. And he ponders upon what does it mean to die, what does it mean to go away. Does it mean that that the physicality has to go away? If this is the case, the number of people, despite the fact that they are living, are dead in my life, because I had so many friends or whatever, girlfriends or boyfriends or close people to heart, and they were the most important people in such and such period of time, and suddenly they vanish. They're with somebody else, they're somewhere else. I don't even have a contact with them. In fact, it's a death, physically speaking, from one's standpoint. And on the other hand, you know, whether the memory of human beings is kind of a capsule that can carry this flame of this other person's spirit. So whether, you know, if I remember someone, and if this someone gave me something, and if I have feelings for this someone, is this that I am carrying his sort of soul in me? It is a, am I carrying his light, this spiritual essence that is the essence of us? Do I carry it with me? And therefore, if I am carrying with you, it with me, as long as I am alive, this person is alive spiritually. Mm-hmm. And it's just, let's say this, therefore the title is Metaphysics, because it's imponderabilia. He thinks about things which are unresolved. You cannot come to terms because we don't know what is death. We can stand at its gate, but we cannot really cross it. Once we cross it, we are in a different dimension, or we are not. I mean, depends on whom you're talking to. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot to say about the living who are left after somebody is dying. So, but the film takes a different, a slightly different approach. And because, you know, you cannot have letters in the movie. So the film is assembled from the bits and pieces of him lovingly filming their relationship. So as one of the reviewers, I think in New York Times, wrote, this puts to shame other love stories because it's so intimate. Because it's, I experimented with this film because I have selected the actors and I trained them to use the little camera, and there were a number of scenes when I discussed them with them before shooting, and then I left them on the spot in this apartment with the camera, and they had to perform it on their own. So I would have this effect of authenticity, that this is not a film crew standing behind and sort of shining the lamps into their eyes and whatever, breathing down their necks and sort of picking up any sound that is there. But rather, this is kind of as close to the truth that one can get. Again, the truth is unapproachable as well. All these big things are, unfortunately, we can only stand at the gate.
Mm-hmm. You can't manipulate the truth. It has to reveal itself, I guess.
Well, you know, the truth is such a broad term. I mean, depends what you talk about, the truth. And yeah, this is one of those sinkholes that many ideas have fallen into, because basically any manipulator can tell you that anything is true. And then,
well, we know that these days in Bush's America.
I mean, the truth is bent and twisted and stretched. And but I think, I mean, yeah. Well, but when we harping back at philosophy and Kant and what is the phenomenon, the things that we see and we think they are truths, and the things which are the inner real truth, which is unapproachable. That's been always the case in philosophy, that the real truth, the real essence is unapproachable. Phenomen and noumen in Kant, right? In Kant's philosophy.
And the more we try to pin the truth down, the more we alter it and it changes, or it slips out from under our control. You've done a number of things. I want to mention that your novels are in English. They've been translated. They're available. Your poetry as well.
Only poetry. The novels are translated, but not published yet. I'm talking with the publisher now, that he might be bringing it up. Also, my films were just, because the Museum of Modern Art retrospective started a certain wave, and that wave went into other sites and cinemas and museums, and the retrospective traveled to Vancouver, it traveled to National Gallery in Washington, to the Art Institute of Chicago, UCLA, University of Colorado in Boulder. It was in Seattle a few weeks ago. I just came to Portland from Berkeley, where the Berkeley Art Museum was having it, and now this is in the Portland Northwest, which is the part also for from Portland Art Museum. This is in essence one institution almost.
You're talking about the series of the film series that's been shown.
And this this generated a lot of press, particularly press in big cities. This is a funny thing that I am getting a lot of reviews in, like Washington Post, which carried every day a major review and an in-depth essay. And but I don't get anything in Portland or Seattle. No, very tiny little mentions. This is weird for me because I thought it would be working other way, because these big publications have this necessity of only writing about the commercial stuff, because the advertising pages are sponsored by, and so on and so on. And it works the other way around. I don't get any notice in these papers here.
Portland is a small town in a lot of ways. I wanted to...
But, you know, I expect it's the opposite, that in Portland I would get a write-up or at least an article about my... after all, I'm coming to Portland and, you know, it's not that many things are happening at the moment and there's very little about it. And people don't know about it. And
tomorrow is Thanksgiving. This is
yeah, but you know, there's always something tomorrow. We don't know what is tomorrow.
You are first of all a poet. Could you talk as we approach the conclusion about your poetry and some of the titles that are available that you especially recommend for us?
No, it's very hard to talk about poetry, you know, because poetry is something that you don't talk about. You write it and it takes you a while to write just a few words.
Right. And so, grateful for the words.
Yes. But it's a great school for... my friend who is a mathematician has a perfect description of what is poetry. I mean, he says that if you're not a poet, you're looking at a line... you have to, like a geometric line, which is a straight line, you have to sort of pan your head from left to right or from right to left, and this line is endless. And you cannot, and it actually circles, and you can spin around, and because this line doesn't have the end and the beginning. What the poet does, the poet sort of approaches this line and stands at 180 degrees to this line, so it goes as a point through his eye. And that's a nice geometric description what a poet does. So he sees the line as a point. He can capture it, therefore he can see the entirety of it by this symbol of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I guess in conclusion, I'd like to know what your current project is.
That's what I am not going to talk about, because I never talk about my current and future projects, because it's like John Lennon who said, you know, in his last song, unfortunately, life is what happens to you when you make other plans.
One of the finest lines ever uttered. This has been Jay Thiemeyer talking with Lech Majewski, the filmmaker, who's... series of wonderful films are currently being screened at the Northwest Film Center. They're at the Witzel Auditorium. Two films remain: Garden of Earthly Delights, which is Wednesday night at 7, the 28th, and the conclusion with Angelus at 8:45, Friday the 30th. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That should do it.